Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
It's now been four nights that Sweden's capital has been subjected to riots by hundreds of dissatisfied youths. The rioting followed the killing of a man wielding a machete and is taking place among immigrant suburbs. If you read the articles, the riots are blamed on anger, racism, and an increasingly divided society. It's the haves versus the have-nots, a refrain often heard even from our own president. This anger is linked to the recent arrival of asylum seekers, but this resentment cannot be solely blamed on immigration. For all countries have had immigration with no rioting. This unrest arises from an internal cancer, an erosion of a country's exceptionalism called patriotism, which once encouraged a sense of belonging among immigrants. Once you no longer believe you're great, then neither do they. And humans smell weakness like sharks sense blood. This is the new Stockholm Syndrome. Not simply embracing your captors, but sacrificing your world with nothing but rage to replace it. See the brutal terror killing in England. Now to assimilate is a sign of weakness. For some, a separate identity takes precedence over unity. The melting pot has become an angry buffet. Side by side, we eye each other and wonder why he has more than me. This thinking flows from the top. This is not a good place to be, but it's where we are headed, or worse, beheaded.
Nice.
Bob, you made a point last night that stuck with me. When people move from places that aren't very good, they should seem happy or at least welcome the challenge that comes with moving to a better place, a place where there's more opportunity. But what we're seeing now is a different kind.
Well, the interesting thing about this, the influx of people from other countries, is they tend to stay together in communities.
Right.
And their own resentment sort of builds. What this is going to have, I think, you watch in the next 4 or 5 years, the ascendancy in Europe particularly of the anti-immigration groups that have been getting stronger and stronger politically. They've had them in Germany. They've had them in Sweden. Matter of fact, they've elected some people to some of the parliaments there. So I think that, but in our own country, the question I raise is, what does this do to the immigration bill? The only thing I think Obama's got left is an immigration bill. Mm-hmm. What was hanging on that was the Republicans needed it. I'm not so sure now. I mean, I think maybe it survives, but it's a testament. Look, you make a decision to let people come into your country. It used to be that it made it stronger. Mm-hmm. Now it makes it weaker.
Yeah, KG, you immigrated from Venus.
Yes.
California.
From California, actually. From San Francisco. Does this kind of frighten you?
I like Venus.
Do you see this spreading?
Listen, they're reaping what they have sown. When you look at the problem, it's not unique to Sweden. You're seeing it in the UK. You're seeing it in France because liberal immigration policies and a quest and thirst for multiculturalism has produced this very result. You don't see people like Angela Merkel in Germany having this type of problem because they're much more strict about who they let. I'm sorry to tell you, but when you look at the empirical evidence and the facts, it's there.
Yeah.
This is the problem. And you're seeing it across, in countries that are having these liberal policies. And you really need to be more certain about who you're letting in, especially then when it comes to extended families. There's loopholes for people who want to do harm to be able to get in. Look what happened to us with Boston.
It's not about, let's cut down the chase. It's not about liberal policies. It's about Muslims. I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
Well, whose policy is that?
I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. Who were the rioters in the last four nights? It was mostly young Muslim immigrants, right? Or people who were born in London, the same thing. This is a part and parcel of a bigger picture having to do with the question of the Muslim religion versus.
I agree with that, but who's deciding that this is a good policy? Who is making it loose, and then you're allowing people to come in that want to do a country harm?
I think it's because we believe that assimilation is rude to an incoming culture, right?
There's assimilation and there's radicalization. Mm-hmm. What happens is the environments or groups or countries or governments that want to be more diverse and they want to have freer, open, more open borders, they look for the assimilation, but the radicals look for those same groups, those same countries, those same governments, and say, hey, here's a good opportunity. Yeah. We have an opportunity to go in on these where they have open borders like this and radicalize a certain percentage of the population, and they've achieved their goals. So, Bob, to your answer, yes, I think it is the more liberal countries and governments that allow more people in, and the radical Islamists say that's where we need to target because that's where we're going to
water takes the path of least resistance. So why wouldn't you go to a country that has a liberal immigration policy than trying to get into a tough
group? I think most of those countries where people have come in, they've been fine and they've added to society and they've gotten in, they've assimilated fine.
I think there's something different going on here. Dana, last word.
My only word?
Yes, and it better be a good
block.
One. Don't say Jasper.
The Swedish are a very generous people. Mm-hmm. They love their country and they were willing to share it with people. It's not just the immigration policy that's liberal. It's the benefits that come with getting to the country. And what I think one of the things they have to do is if you commit a crime, then boom, your family, not allowed in. Mm-hmm. Because that starts to have an effect. Mm. Assimilation has to be a two-way street. Mm-hmm. There's work that we have to do when people want to come into our country to help them get here. But you can't not assimilate into the country and then be angry about it and put people's cars on fire. Problem is, it used to be that they wanted to get a car like yours. No. Now they want your car. And
context of white supremacy. Wowee, that was fascinating. And if you have been listening to the cows for a minute, you have heard that before. This is not the first time we've had guests on the program from Sweden. At any rate, it is Monday, September 29th, 2014. So I have been told it is a little after 6 a.m. Pacific local time for Gus T. It is very early. I just want to get that timestamp in for anyone who says that we do not work hard here on the cows or we lollygag or lazy about doing things. Just timestamp 6 a.m. We are up, ready to roll to hopefully give constructive information on the system of racism, white supremacy as a global system. Again, this is not the first time we've had folks on from Sweden. If you remember, we played that clip. We were live time when the rioting happened, so-called rioting, last spring. We had Yalo Momodou on the program. He's been with us twice. Folks recall the first time he was with us was in 2011. He reported a slave auction party where white students were, some of them were dressing up pretending to be slaves, and some of the other white students, they were going to have a good old auction to reminisce about the plantation days of racism. And he reported this correctly as unjust and racist. And then some white man decided that he was upset about this and then went and posted all these Photoshop images of Mr. Momodou as a runaway slave all over the town, and this became a big story, but we had him on in 2011. You can go in the archives to hear both of his visits. We also had Mr. Makode Linda. He is the black male artist who made the racist cake that got a lot of attention in 2012. He was on in the spring to talk about a lot of things. Him growing up in Sweden as a non-white male and being chased by Nazis and all the information about the cake and the response. You can go back in the archives to hear all of that. Always enjoy hearing folks from different parts of the world. Our guest for today's program, he was recently one of the featured guests on The Stream, Al Jazeera's news program, and they talk pretty regularly about racism. They were talking specifically about this new proposal in Sweden to remove the term race from any of their legislation. And the reason for this, allegedly, is that race is a social construct. So if we remove the term race, then people will be less likely to identify and be beholden to this concept of race. So ostensibly, this should minimize racism. We've heard this before. Folks in other parts of the world have heard similar logic, and I do not think it's going to help to eradicate racism. Our guests seem to offer a similar opinion. We thought it would be grand to have him on the program to get more details. In addition, to being on the stream. He is frequently on television and quoted in newspapers in the Swedish area to give his views on racism. He is the Secretary General of the National Afro-Swedish Association. It's linked if you're listening at Black Talk Radio. You can just click it and go to their website. You might need to translate the page, but you can do so easily. Read more information about things that they have been involved in. Fascinating. You should be able to cover some of those details as well. Real pleasure to have him on the program, joining us live from Sweden, our guest, Mr. Katimbwa Sabuni. Mr. Sabuni, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. Glad to be on the show.
Pleasure is ours. Thank you so much. I know it's, I guess, mid-afternoon for you, so we're thankful you could share some of your Monday with us. For listeners, this might be their first time hearing about you and the work that you do. Is there anything that you think listeners should know about you before we get started?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a good idea for you to ask me the questions, and I try to be helpful in any way I can. As you were saying, I am the Secretary General of the National Afro-Swedish Association, and in this capacity, I have been dealing with racism in Sweden for a long time. And even as a black male, to be truthful, you have to deal with white supremacy and racism in Sweden on a regular daily basis, which is something that isn't always recognized in this country. So I'm happy to have this chance to talk about that.
We are happy as well, sir. You've already stated you are a black male. That's when we get out early and talking to folks. Also, definition for racism. We start every program, this broadcast, context of white supremacy. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe such a system exists? Do you think that's an accurate definition?
I think it was a fascinating definition, and it's actually the first time that I heard it. I definitely can. I support a lot of what you were saying there. There's something though, which is that I don't think that many of these white people need to even be dedicated to this white supremacy system. They're totally a part of it, and they reap all the benefits from it. But they don't even have to be dedicated to it because it's just granted to them. Without them even have to think, they don't even think about it many times. So I would say that most white people would say that they are not dedicated to white supremacy. As in that definition, it says that they need to be dedicated to it. So I'm at odds with that, but for the rest of it, I'm totally in agreement. It is a system that gives white people privilege and non-white people negative consequences, yes.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I would respond quickly. You are absolutely right. Most of the white people that we talk to worldwide, they are adamant that they are not dedicated to racism, white supremacy, and that they abhor such a thing and that they are all about justice. But quite frankly, I do not believe them. I have, and really for me, a lot of that just boils down to what it means to be white. But I have concluded that white people, they are very informed. In fact, I have concluded that on this planet, doesn't matter whether you're in Sweden, New York, Paris, South Africa, you cannot be ignorant about what it means to be white and what your duties and obligations are as a white person, or you will get in trouble with other white people generally in short order. They will let you know when you have stepped out of line as a white man, white woman, with regards to what you are supposed to be doing in this global system of racism, white supremacy. Have you seen any evidence to that would lead you to believe that that is truthful when white people say that they don't think about or that they are ignorant about racism? Have you come to a conclusion about whether they're being honest when they say that?
Well, I would say that I think that they are oblivious to this thing in a way that I would call they're voluntarily oblivious to it. So definitely they could get informed quite easily on these topics, but for some reasons they don't get informed. So I think that it's a kind of chosen oblivion, but I do still think that when most white people think that they are against racism, they believe themselves when they say it. I do think so. Because I think that a system of power that is based on calculation solely and not self-righteousness, I think that would have become quite unstable in a while. So I think that white people definitely need to believe that they are in the right in order to perpetuate this system as well as they are doing. It's my conclusion, and I think it has something to do with human psychology. But I'm open for other interpretations, definitely. But that's just what I think. And from interacting with white people as much as I have done, and just in these interactions, you know, see how strongly they react to any suggestions of you know, white privilege and how they are part of it and how they perpetuate it. I have to reach the conclusion that they actually believe themselves when they say that they are against racism.
Hmm. That is fascinating. I'm not an expert on racism. I study, but I don't claim to be an expert. I have heard a lot of that myself when white people say that they are really adamant that they are against racism or that they're not racist or that they're ignorant. I've just concluded it's pretty much like any other criminal activity, that generally criminals do not want to be identified as a criminal, whether you're a rapist or a shoplifter or whatever the case may be. They will generally deny, and particularly if denying can help them continue their criminal endeavor. And that's kind of what I've concluded with whites. The way I would even ask my question this way, the recent elections, and this is getting a little ahead, but just I think it's connected to what we're talking about here. The New York Times, they had an article that came out September 16th. It's Sweden looks to exclude far right from coalition. I'm not going to read the whole thing, just to kind of get some of the high points. Sweden, a country synonymous with stable government, generous welfare, and liberal immigration policies, entered a new era on Monday as its fragmented political mainstream scrambled to form a coalition government strong enough to exclude the surging far right. Elections held Sunday gave the center-left enough votes to take power from the governing center-right alliance, yet neither bloc won a majority. But the Sweden Democrats, an anti-immigrant party, more than doubled their vote and now hold the balance of power in parliament. On Monday, the popular tabloid Expression published a front page starkly displaying on a black background the number of Swedes who voted for the Sweden Democrats. More than 780,000, or almost 13% of the total vote. Thousands of protesters gathered in Stockholm, Gothenburg, and Malmo on Monday to protest against racism in reaction to the Sweden Democrats, who have roots in the white supremacist movement. I will stop there. Do you think the white members of the Sweden Democrats, do you think that they are ignorant about their role as white people and how that relates to racism, white supremacy?
Well, I think not. As you were saying, this is the party that has its roots in the white supremacist movement. And time after time, they do this in the journals and the news, the media. They do these exposés where they show how the members of this party, the way they talk about non-white people and they think that no one here, the way that they are active on the internet, on different blogs, and you know, producing commentary that's totally and openly racist, and so on and so forth. So no, I wouldn't say that. And definitely I think that the people that vote for the Sweden Democrats, they are not primarily disenchanted, and they are not primarily unemployed, and that's why they vote for this and that. Because it actually goes deeper, and I think that it harkens back to this idea of Sweden being a country for Swedish people. And Swedish people are white people, so they should definitely be, in a way, superior to people who are not white, who are not real Swedes. So in this modern welfare state, where before people used to talk about races and superior and inferior races, now they talk about real Swedes versus migrants who are only here because white people allow them to come here. And what they want is that Sweden should be more visibly for the Swedes. So if you are white, then your life and your conditions should be better than other people. They don't want to be white people on par with non-white people. And the Sweden Democrats will make sure that Sweden is a country for white people. But, however, that's not what they would, you know, say openly. But that's what everyone understands, and that's why people vote for the Sweden Democrats. I think, yes. But the Sweden Democrat voters are, you have to appreciate the one thing about them. These people are quite sincere, and they're 30% today. But as you also mentioned, a lot of people were out on the streets demonstrating, you know, a manifestation saying that they were against racism. Of course, most of these people were white people. So there are white people who vote for the Sweden Democrats, and they're way past, you know, any kind of hypocrisy. You just say, I voted for them, so what are you going to do? And then there are white people, like most white people still, who feel that they are anti-racist, and they're even prepared to go out and you know, demonstrate against the Sweden Democrats. But most of these people don't even reflect upon what white supremacy is or white privilege. So they're a part of the problem also, without even, you know, thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I want to kind of rewind a little bit just so that people can kind of know a bit more about your experience growing up in Sweden. You were born in Sweden, is that correct?
Not born in Sweden, but I lived here since I was 4 years old, so practically, yes.
Okay. Where were you born?
I was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I see. Wow, okay. And so you migrate there at four. Did your parents explain why they chose to move to Sweden?
Well, I didn't say much about that. They actually had to move, and they chose Sweden. I might think that it had something to do. You know, my father was a leftist activist, or maybe you should say politician / rebellion in the Congo at a time where there was this opposition against this American-backed dictator called Mobutu Sese Seko. And at that time, things got hot enough, so he had to leave. And he got the chance of saying where he wanted to go. And I think he actually chose Sweden because Sweden had this leader called Olof Palme, who was perceived to be anti-colonial and really pro-third world. So he had this, that's all I think he knew about Sweden. So he had this idea that this was a good progressive country. And I think that was probably the reason that we went to Sweden at that time.
Fascinating. Wow. Okay. That Joseph Mobutu and what happened in the Congo, that definitely would, in my opinion, would definitely relate to global system of racism, white supremacy, and how black people, particularly on the continent of Africa, can just regularly things are disrupted. The hidden hand of racist man, racist woman, causing folks to have to relocate and being dislocated. With regards to you going to Sweden at four at such a young age, what was your experience like as a child in Sweden? Like, was racism a problem? Did you have a lot of white friends? Was it difficult? Was it fun?
Well, Well, you know, I grew up in an area, and I came to Sweden at a time where there weren't many black people in Sweden. There weren't that many migrants living where I lived. And it was a time of, this was back in the 80s. I think the times were a bit different. But of course I experienced racism. I mean, white people can be, you have no problem with them until you have a problem with them. And then at that time, white people resort to racism. Well, let's take an example. Two children playing. They're good friends, and everything's all right. And then for some reason, they don't get along. Then for some reason, this white kid will call the black kid, you know, whatever, your darky, N-word, whatever. You see what I mean? So this white kid is actually, using the power of the white supremacist or racism and this historical and cultural and social and economical context to try to put the black kid in his place by just uttering a word. And the white kid can do that when he or she chooses to do that. And, of course, I would say that that's an example of racism, but it doesn't only have, it's not something that only relates to those two children. It actually relates to society as a whole. If you say that that has something to do with racism in Sweden, they will say, no, this is just kids, you know, and kids are stupid. So that's an example that I can draw from childhood. And I think that it has relevance even when you're grown up and people vote for these racist parties. And then they say, well, no. It's not that they're racist or something. It's just that they're upset about whatever. They lost their job or something. So that's my kind of experience. So, of course, you have racism. And then you have the kind of racism that is, you know, the racism of lower expectations, of course. And then there is that racism where you're being made to feel exotic, you know, you're fascinating to white people. That can be done to children a lot. You know, people want to, you know, touch you, feel your hair, and, you know, have you answer questions about Africa, whatever. So, you have all kinds of things. But was it aggressive? Rarely. Not that often, no.
Were you just... To clarify, were you at any point called a nigger or terms like that while you were growing up?
Definitely. I mean, while I was growing up, you had to defend yourself because that was the kind of attacks that you could expect that could happen to you. And the funny thing is that, as I'm trying to say, is that you can have great relations with white Swedish people. Until the point where they get upset with you for whatever reason, and then they start using the N-word, as I was saying. So what do you make of people like that? Most white people would say that, oh, that means that these people aren't racist because they have black friends, because they are not, you know, openly racist when they don't have a specific issue with a black person. See what I mean? But I think that it's only when white people have some kind of issue that they become ostensibly racist, like visibly racist, and say stuff. And it's because racism is a system of power that they can use. It's at their disposal to be used when they feel like it. And if they use it, then we should be able to say that, well, that means that they're racist. And if they abstain from using it, then we can say, well, this is a white person that's trying to do the right thing. So, but that's not how it's defined here. But to answer your question, well, of course that happened to me, yes.
That, to me, would suggest if these white people are normally well-behaved, they're courteous, you can hang out with them, might even be considered friends, you can go grab a meal, go to the movies, whatever. But once there's a point of contention, whatever the case may be, where they feel aggrieved, and you are the target of their anger as a black person or non-white person, and at that point it becomes racial, whether they're calling you nigger or other racist names or what have you. To me, that suggests these white people are not ignorant. that they are informed about what it means to be white, what it means for you to be a non-white person, and how they relate to you as a black person. Just to me, that suggests that they are very informed, whether they are displaying their knowledge of racism on a regular basis, displaying their racist ideas and racist behavior. That's a different discussion, but with regards to them understanding it, that right there to me suggests that they have a thorough understanding of what it means to be white and racism, white supremacy, if that makes sense.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and I think that that's your interpretation. I wouldn't necessarily say that it was wrong. I think that they, white people themselves, have created systems of knowledge that makes them able to go on thinking that they can behave in this way and still not be racist.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where there was this debate going on about racial profiling in Sweden. And a well-known young writer wrote an opinion piece in one of the major newspapers where he tried to explain what he spoke about his experiences growing up as a non-white male. And then there was this this person working for the integration minister, his closest aide, who wrote a piece, answering him, saying that, you know what, you said that you were harassed by police officers. Well, you can't go around saying that they're racist just because they harassed you because you weren't white, because who knows? Maybe they had a bad day. Maybe he had a fight with his wife before coming to work that day. So, naturally, he starts harassing non-white people. So, for them, this racist reaction, it just comes so naturally. So it's not a racist reaction, just a natural reaction to some other grievance in their life. And they can, go on thinking that they're not racist for that. Of course, we would know better and argue that, well, look, that's what racism is about. But they can still go on thinking that they're not racist. I'll tell you one thing, though. Calling someone a racist in Sweden is considered a much worse offense than actually victimizing someone and making them victims of racism in many ways. I would say that, definitely.
Well, that does not surprise me at all. It tends to be pretty similar here and most around the world. When I've heard people report on this, that tends to be similar. Even someone with as much money, and many people would say she's very powerful, Oprah Winfrey, when she was, I'm forgetting my country, if she was in Switzerland or Sweden, but she was overseas, a European country. She went to buy a purse of some sort that I guess was pretty pricey, and the folks didn't recognize her. The white person that was waiting on her didn't recognize her and just said, you can't afford that. You don't really want to look at that. Look at something else. And she eventually talked about this, and she said that she felt it was an act of racism. And she got in so much trouble, and she ended up having to come out and apologize for saying this about the shop that she was at. It's not like she named the person. She didn't have a big billboard with this person's picture on it and her name and home address. She didn't do any of that. She just said that this is very common, where a lot of black people, when they go in stores, are mistreated or followed or talked to as though they can't afford to make a purchase. And she got exactly what you just said. She got fussed at, where she ended up having to come out and apologize for making this accusation. I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I'm just saying that I think that's fascinating. It's just fascinating, and it's a good example, because Oprah is wealthy and in many ways powerful, but you can't get away from racism just because you're wealthy. I mean, we have a black man in the White House, and for that reason, a lot of black people say that we'll reach the end of history. There's no more racism going on. So it actually, in many ways, became more of a problem than progress for black people to have, some of these successful black people in this white supremacist order.
Absolutely.
But it's funny also the example that you drew upon with Oprah, because here in Sweden, white people love Oprah. So Oprah got a lot of sympathy for that. But what they were saying weren't that, I mean, it's horrible that black people should be treated this way. They were saying that it's horrible that Oprah should be treated that way. Don't they know she's a billionaire? Don't they recognize Oprah? I mean, this is an outrage. So that was something that I remarked upon a lot, because they weren't saying that it's bad that black people are being treated. They were shocked that Oprah was being treated that way.
Wow. That is, even that is not surprising. She is special, and she's not supposed to be treated like the rest of you black people. Wow. It parallels so much. I think the report that you were referencing, Jonas Hansen Kamiri, he also got published in the New York Times, where he wrote a very powerful piece just talking about growing up in Sweden as a non-white person and everything that he was subjected to. I don't want to read the whole thing, but just so people kind of get a flavor of what he's talking about in this piece, and then you can let us know if this mirrors your experience in any way. He wrote, he's talking about, on March 7, the minister told a nationwide audience, "One's experience of why someone has questioned me can, of course, be very subjective, suggesting that racially profiled subway passengers were overreacting and that their anger was irrational. Without missing a beat," she continued, "there are some who have been previously convicted and feel that they are always questioned, even though you can't tell by looking at a person that they have committed a crime. It was an interesting choice of words, previously convicted, because that's exactly what we are, all of us who are guilty until proven innocent. We Swedes who do not fit the outdated blonde, blue-eyed stereotype of what a true Swede should look like. We whose personal experience makes us doubt our country's international reputation of being a paradise with equal opportunities for everyone. We remember the shame and the slights. Being 6 years old and walking towards passport control with Dad, who has sweaty hands, who clears his throat, who fixes his hair and shines up his shoes on the back of his knees. All the pink-colored people are let by, but our Dad is stopped, and we think maybe it was by chance until we see the same scene repeated year after year. Being 7 and starting school and being told about society by a Dad who was terrified even then that his outsiderness would be inherited by his children. He says, when you look like we do, you must always be 1,000 times better than everyone else if you don't want to be refused. Being 8 and deciding to become the class's most studious nerd, the world's biggest brown noser. Being 9 and watching action films where dark men rape and kidnap, manipulate and lie, steal and abuse. Being 10 and chased by skinheads for the first time, but not the last time. Being 12 and coming into a record store and noticing how the security guards circle like sharks. They talk into walkie-talkies. They follow only a few yards behind us, move in maximally non-criminal fashion, walk normally, breathe calmly, walk up to that shelf of CDs and reach for that Tupac album in a way that indicates you are not planning to steal it. Being 13 and hearing stories, a friend's older brother tossed into a police van and beaten up, Dad's friend N, who was found by a police patrol and locked up in the drunk tank because he was slurring and the police didn't notice until the next day that something was wrong, and in the ER they found the aneurysm, and at his funeral his girlfriend said, if only they had called me, I could have told them that he didn't drink alcohol, all while our city was besieged by a xenophobe with a rifle and a laser sight who shot 11 dark-haired men in 7 months without the police stepping in. I'll stop there, but it goes on to give quite a bit more. Very powerful piece, in my opinion. Does this sound relevant? Do you recall when this piece was written and the response to it?
Yes, actually, I mean, the tweet by Younes Hassan Kamir was what I was actually referring to earlier, and I'm really glad to see that you guys are so informed, trying to keep informed of the situation of black people all around the world. And that tweet by Kamir, I think it captures so well this the feeling that you have growing up in Sweden. As a non-white person, which I think resembles probably the experience you have in the United States. But I think that there is this slight difference also, because I don't think that, I mean, you cannot, I don't think white people can argue that black people in the United States has no right to be there or to exist. Whereas here, there's also that component where your very existence here is being challenged to the point where his father, coming home from a trip abroad, has that feeling that he has to present himself in a way so as not to be harassed by the people in immigration and things of that nature, which is something that we live with constantly growing up here. And at the same time, as you're being told in so many different ways that you are not of this place, that you don't belong here, many of us, we don't have a strong connection to where our parents might have come from. And so on. So it really creates a psychological tension within you. And it's a kind of racism that it's a form of torture for young people, definitely. And also, it's not addressed, it's not recognized, it's just taken for, you know, there's nothing there, so no one talks about it. So I appreciated the piece by Kamir. It was very strong.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I will post it on my Facebook page and tweet it out, so folks, if you want to read the full segment, I would definitely encourage that. I would say quickly, I definitely point taken, I understand exactly what you mean about this idea that you don't belong here. Go back to wherever you came from or wherever your parents came from. You're obviously not Swedish. That is not exactly the same for black people in the United States, but they do have a habit frequently, white people, not all, but many of them, of saying, if you don't like it, go back to Africa. Even President Obama was told this during the 2012 campaign, that we can send him back to Kenya. So it's not exactly the same, but you do hear a lot of that pretty regularly over here. Even President Obama gets told, you can go back to Africa too. So,
Fascinating stuff. And the funny thing is, you know, I doubt that many black people would like to send anyone anywhere. Because what white people want is not this racially separate existence. In my opinion, they want superiority. They want to be superior in a way that is self-evident, you know, like in a way the way it was in apartheid South Africa or in segregationist United States, where whiteness was, you know, a sign of nobility. It came natural to you. You as a white person, you wouldn't risk seeing a black person with a better car than you do. You wouldn't risk going to the office and having a black person being your boss or your senior manager. Things of that nature. And I don't think that a lot of white people even, you know, think about it that way, but I think that that's what it's all about. And they would be happy to have us here, you know, fixing their gardens, driving kids to whatever soccer practices and, you know, cleaning up their homes and all kinds of stuff. That's no problem to them. I think so anyway. So it's definitely this thing. And white people can't be superior if there aren't any black people to be superior to. So I think we are an integral part of even the most racist white people's worldview.
I totally agree with that, because I definitely know here in the States, I suspect this, if you want to talk about South Africa, it would have been very easy for the Afrikaners, if they really had a problem with black people, they could have exterminated them. And I don't think anybody in the 60s, 70s, 80s, I seriously doubt that anybody would have stepped up forcefully to say, we're going to stop this. We have got black South Africans back. We're going to defend them. You are not going to go and just murder these people. I think they could have easily done that. And the word, I mean, you might have had some lip service, like, oh, my God, I can't believe you did this. This is horrible. But I don't think it would have been, you know, we're putting boots on the ground. This is not going to happen. You're going to have to, you know, go through us to do this. And I just, I totally agree. I think that they really enjoy having that, looking down on black people, having them as nannies, and in just a really degraded position so that they can enjoy abusing and degrading black people. Exactly as you said, exercising superiority and abuse of black people. That is, I think they get so much enjoyment out of that that they would really have a problem if there were no black people around for them to abuse and look down on.
You also have to look at this capitalist system that we're living under. If I can call it a white capitalist system, because it's a white supremacist order. And within these order, I mean, even most white people are becoming losers. So what's left for them? I mean, being white used to be being right all of the time, and now you find yourself in a situation where increasingly you have nothing, you feel like nothing. So if there weren't any black people around for you to look down upon, if you couldn't turn on the TV and see the mess that Africa is, and see the way people live there, and see the diseases, and see the all of those things, you wouldn't be able to say, well, I'm quite well off anyway. I mean, my life isn't that bad anyway. I am somebody because I'm not like them. So definitely, I think it's important that there's black people around and that they are in subjugated positions. And of course, I think that this might sound offensive to a lot of white people, and it's because they haven't been socialized into thinking about these things in this way, or challenging themselves to think about it in these ways. But if you were to suggest this with some kind of gender analysis and tell this to Swedish people, I think that most Swedish men would agree, oh, yes, it's true that we, as males, want to dominate and subjugate women. So it's definitely true. They don't mind that kind of analysis. Maybe they mind, but not the way they mind if you suggest that racism also has something to do with the way things are. So I think that's very interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. You touched on the concept, and I thought it was interesting because I hear, really over the last 6 months or so, I've heard a lot of this same rhetoric and this exact same term being used in the U.S., but you talked about exceptionalism and how white people in Sweden, they like to use that term almost in a way of reverence and self-congratulations about their just and civilized behavior. What does that concept mean, and how is it used amongst white people in Sweden, exceptionalism?
I'm glad you asked me that question, because, if you say that exceptionalism is something particular to whiteness, I would agree. And some of the race biological pseudoscientists from back in the days, they used to argue that the Scandinavians were the whitest of the white, the purest of the pure. And interestingly, I think that idea has had a life of its own and continues in the way in which Scandinavians, and more in particular Swedish people, seem to think that they are exceptional even among white people, in the sense where other white people might be racist, might have those kind of ideas and those issues and those problems, but Sweden is different. It's an island of tolerance. So maybe like 50 years ago, being racist was a good thing. So Swedish people were racist just like all other white people, maybe the most racist, I don't know, whatever. But now, since racism is perceived to be a bad thing, at least officially, now Swedish people are the less racist people in the whole world. They actually managed to reconstruct their own history, where Sweden is being construed as a country that had nothing to do with transatlantic slave trade, nothing to do with the production of knowledge that legitimized the subjugation and enslavement of black people and led into these modern ideas of race, biology, and whatever, what have you. That Sweden had nothing to do with that. And Sweden has always been against things like colonialism and apartheid in South Africa and so on and so forth. And all of this is actually something that people believe in. It's like state religion. And all of this has led to the present, where it's very hard to speak about racism in Sweden today. Like the riots that we alluded to in the beginning, where they talked about these riots in Sweden. Still in Sweden, they don't like to talk about that as some like race riots or something that has to do with racial inequality. They will say that, oh, that is something to do with failed integration policies. Whereas the stuff that goes on in Ferguson in the United States, oh, that has to do with racist police officers and, you know, the whole American dilemma with racism. So I think that's very interesting, that racism can never come back to Sweden and become a problem here.
That was part of the pushback. If folks, I think I linked it. If you're listening at Black Talk Radio, the segment that Mr. Sabuni did on the stream a few weeks back, where they were talking about the removal of the term race from legal aspects and law in Sweden, that was part of the pushback. One of the other folks that was being interviewed, he said that, well, Mr. Sabuni, you're talking about Sweden as though they were some big colonial empire, and that's just not so. They were not like France or Great Britain. They were not out some big slave empire conquering and dominating non-white people. So you're just giving a false narrative in trying to say that white people in Sweden have behaved in an imperialistic, racist manner. And what evidence would you provide to push back on that and say that that is false, this kind of revisionist history, to say that Sweden has been an exception to the racist conduct of white people globally?
Well, I think that kind of argument is like saying that the Belgians that colonized the Congo and the atrocities that had led to, is like suggesting that the Belgians weren't big racist or colonialist as the French, because their colonial empire was smaller. I mean, it had nothing to do with what kind of people they were, but it actually had more to do with the kind of power that they had in the world. So Sweden stopped being a major power actually at the time when the transatlantic slave trade took a hold and became a major enterprise, and that's when Sweden stopped being a major power. So it wasn't from lack of trying that Sweden didn't become this slave trading major power. It was because they were outcompeted by more powerful countries. So I can't see how you can use that as some kind of way of saying that you're morally superior just because you failed at a racist enterprise with others. Succeeded better than you. So it's a silly thing to say. And also, I think you have to look at Europe as a whole. The way we speak about Africa and how Africa was affected by slavery, we need to talk about Europe in the same way. Because some countries provided the manpower. Some countries provided capital. Some countries, like Sweden, provided raw materials or the iron that was used to trade when you obtained enslaved or kidnapped Africans and transported them to the West Indies and so on and so on. So in some countries they had a lot of so-called scientists that provided that made this thing legitimate by producing knowledge that made it okay. It's like the Swedish well-known scientist Carl von Linné. And that was one of the pioneers when it came to race biology and the idea of you know, some races being inferior and so on. So this was definitely a European enterprise, and no one can suggest that Sweden wasn't part of Europe and wasn't part of this racist and slavery enterprise like most other European countries. So I think that's the way to look at it. But most Swedish historians, Swedish institutions, they have another take on it.
Part of this came out when they were having this debate about whether they're going to remove the term race from Swedish legislation, and they wrote in one of the articles, the Swedish Society for Eugenics was established in 1909, and in 1922, the Swedish National Institute for Race Biology was opened in Uppsala, the first such institution in the world. The research institute was headed for nearly 15 years by Herman Lundborg, a physician with anti-Semitic views and an adamant advocate of racial hygiene and eugenics. Some have even said the institute inspired Nazi biopolitics. The institute later became associated with a sterilization program for people with negative genetic characteristics, a program which was not terminated until 1975. That, to me, sounds like the essence of white supremacy racism being played out in thought and action. I know Yalo Momodou, when he was on the program the first time around, he gave a lot of the background information talking about just this long history. And exactly as you said, it's not like this is isolated. You had white people around the world who were buying in aggressively, buying in and acting out on these racist ideas, forcibly sterilizing many non-white people, especially black people. Worldwide, that happened right here in the United States, also up until the 70s. We're not talking about stuff that happened 200 years ago, 500 years ago. We're talking about things that happened in a lot of people who are listening to this program in their lifetime that this happened. Some of these people are still around who were forcibly sterilized and not able to have children. I did want to mention, since you brought it up, that they will give a comparison contrast to say that, well, we here in Sweden, we are not racist. You know, we're civilized. We're about tolerance and acceptance. Racism is what's happening in Ferguson. Has that been discussed? What's been transpiring, I guess, for about almost 2 months now, the shooting death of Michael Brown and Ferguson? And if so, how is that talked about in Sweden?
Well, it's talked about in Sweden as black people's reaction to the racism in the United States. So people here are quite in agreement that there is a problem with racism in Sweden, in the United States, where for example the police they do racial profiling systematically, where people here know that black males are more likely to be in prison than whites, a lot more likely, and they know that in the United States people of color are less likely to finish college, and they know about the income inequalities, and they know about all of those things. So it's not surprising that black people should revolt in the United States. And what they're seeing is that you have some. You need to develop more. You need to become more modern or progressive or whatever, the way people are in Sweden. But when you see the exact same phenomena in Sweden, or you could actually show the exact same statistics in Sweden if you would like to, but we don't gather those kinds of statistics in Sweden that would show, for instance, the level of incarceration of black people in Sweden. We don't have the kind of statistics that would show income disparities between different races, the attainment in academia, and so we don't have that. So we don't know about those things, and that means that can't be a problem in Sweden. I actually know that there was this one person that tried to look at Swedish colleges and universities and how many black people worked in the faculties. And it just became an endeavor that they just you can just stop because they didn't find any. They were hardly any around, you see. But since we don't have any of those statistics in Sweden, because we have you know, decided that that's not relevant to Sweden, then it's nothing. It's not something people talk about here. So that's how they deal with racism here. Racism is always somewhere else, in South Africa, in the United States, or what have you, but never here in Sweden.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest joining us live, Mr. Kintimbwa Sabuni, joining us live from Sweden. Folks have questions. If you would like to dial in, ask anything, feel free. The number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have a question, something you would like to ask. Feel free, chime in. Again, press *6 to get your hand up if you have a question. I also wanted to make sure I asked, because I had said before, your role with the National Afro-Swedish Association. How exactly did you get involved with this organization, and what is it that you all, what are like some of your top goals, things that you're trying to do to counter racism?
Well, I've been involved in this organization since boyhood. And in Sweden, they have this system where they encourage migrant communities to start national associations. And the idea was that these associations should help people to preserve their cultures, and at some point when these migrants were ready to move back home, so to speak, they it would be easier for them. But then what happened during the 80s is that increasingly people started to see that these people weren't moving back anywhere. Actually, they came in and they planned to stay here. So they changed the focus, and then they said, well, you know what, they should work with integration and help integrate their communities into the wider community. And that's what the National Afro-Swedish Association was about. But at some point, where some of us younger people, I was young back then anyway, got the reins, we started thinking that this integration thing, we don't get it. I mean, what are we supposed to be integrated into? I mean, we are the way we are, and we already have the position that we're supposed to have in this system. So we're integrated. What we want to talk about now is equal rights and equal opportunities. And we started organizing more in the lines of a civil rights organization or something like that. So we talk about our human rights and the right not to be discriminated and so on and so on. And that's what we are very much about today, the National Afro-Swedish Association.
Wow. Okay. Again, it's linked. You all can check out the website. It's linked directly on the Black Talk Radio Network page. I saw some of the posts that you all have up. This is, I guess, coming, just past September 24th. Where you all had Do Not Touch My Hair in collaboration with Cafe Pan-African and Afro-Swedish Academy with Salem political scientist Johannes presenting their thesis, Do Not Touch My Hair, A Creative and Innovative Way, highlights Salem power structures and norms in Swedish society that excludes minority groups with a focus on black women. Were you a part of this presentation? And if so, what did it entail?
Unfortunately, I couldn't be there myself, Gus, but I heard about it. I mean, it drew a packed house, so I think there must have been around 200 people there. So there's definitely in Sweden the need to talk about these issues that pertain to black people and the reality of being black in Sweden, which is an experience that has been denied any reality up to this point. We are actually demanding that recognition. So the place was packed. A lot of young people of color from Sweden, and there was a heated debate about the fact that people, if you are a black person or a black woman in particular, people want to invade your space, and they feel that they have a right to touch your hair and ask all kinds of intimate questions about your hair and your person and you know, things of that nature, and the way they exoticize black women and how they present them as commodities in popular culture and all of those things. So I heard that it was a great event.
Well, that, once again, very familiar to what I hear on a constant basis here in the U.S., particularly around black females and their hair, and just being very invasive in terms of encroaching on people's personal space and just kind of rude questions, I would even say. Are there white members of the National Afro-Swedish Association?
Yes, actually, the membership is open to everybody who makes that firm commitment and say that they want to support the causes of the organization and work in solidarity with people of African descent.
About, I guess, how many members total are in the group, and then out of that, how many of them are white?
I would say that there is around 2,000 members, and of them, my guess is maybe between 10-20% white.
Wow. Okay, so that's ballpark about 100 to 200, somewhere in there, white membership.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What would your response be to those who would say, hey, we've seen this pattern consistently when black people make an effort to unite, to form some sort of organization, to get focused on dealing with white supremacy, racism, and the myriad of ways that we're being attacked. Consistently, white people infiltrate, they dilute the focus of the group, and they end up just compromising what the original intent of the organization was set out to be. What would your response to that be?
I would say that that's a very real concern, definitely, and that is something that we all need to be vigilant about, and not just us as black people, but of course it mainly us, but even white people who claim to be in solidarity with the black people should also have that in mind. And having said that, I think there's a point to have different kind of organization. I mean, there's definitely a need for those kind of separatist platforms, and they are actually created, and I know some. And then there's also other kind of platforms like the Afro-Swedish Association, but I think that the National Association of Afro-Swedes will always be majority black, because if it wasn't, then even white people will recognize that we have a problem. But I do also think that white people can contribute something. I think it's wrong to just say that because you are in a position where you benefit from racism, that you can sincerely want to do something against racism and make a sincere effort to challenge some of the privileges that are being given to you unwarrantedly in a racist system. However, I do also recognize that is very hard, and it's beyond most people, but I don't think it's impossible.
Hmm. Have you come in either in your organization or, you know, outside, have you come in contact with any white people that you would say, hey, this white person, male or female, is working diligently. I've concluded that this person does not practice racism, white supremacy, and they're doing everything you could possibly ask a white person to do to produce justice and to help black people in any way that they can. Do you know any white people like that?
Yes, I know white people who are making a sincere effort.
Wow.
In my opinion, they're making a sincere effort. You were saying that do they in all aspects of their lives not benefit from white privileges? So, you know, maybe I didn't get that right, but of course not. That's not the case. But are they contributing? Definitely yes. Definitely yes. I mean, we should also know, at least in Sweden, that you know, with the power of white supremacy in Sweden and white supremacist knowledge production, a lot of people who aren't white are very much a part of the white supremacist system, or actually working hard to defend it and preserve it. It's very problematic. I can never see the black person as an enemy, because he or she is, of course, the victim of the same racism that I am suffering, and that's what, you know, makes a difference from white people. But I must say that there are some brothers and sisters out there that aren't being very helpful, whereas there are some white people who are actually making an effort, and I think we can recognize that.
I would love to chat with some of these folks, the white people that are making an effort. That is, I could not put my hand on one. And we've talked to white people all over the world. We've had hundreds of white people on the program to talk about racism, who've written books or who give lectures, have done documentaries. There's not one single white person that I could point to where I could honestly say, yes, I think this white person is really serious, very sincere about trying to establish justice. They don't do anything to practice racism. And I mean, just on that point alone, I have no idea how that would even be possible, to exist as a white person and not practice racism under the current system.
I didn't say that they didn't practice racism. Mm-hmm. I just said that they're making a sincere effort, okay, which is the difference.
Right.
And I think that if someone is making a sincere effort, and I'm talking a sincere effort, then that can and should be recognized.
I totally agree. If someone is making a sincere effort, I just it's difficult for me to even put those words together with regards to white person sincere. If we're talking in the context of working against racism, that it's very hard for me to even get those words in a sentence together, because I just haven't seen it demonstrated. And I would also point out, it's a major pattern that I've seen where consistently when people talk about white people and them being complicit in the system, the practice of white supremacy, people focus on the benefits that they get, which is true. As a white person, you do. You get all kinds of goodies from the system. I think it is far more important, or at minimum, if we're going to talk about benefits, that should be connected. Those benefits are derived from mistreating, terrorizing black people. It's not just that you get these goodies. These goodies are derived from abusing black people, raping the Congo, raping the entire continent of Africa, enslavement of black people, and just so on and so forth. You don't just get these goodies for nothing. You get these goodies at the expense of black people. And I think white people have done a very good job at manipulating the way that racism is talked about so that it's never talked about as a white person, I practice racism. I do things that result directly, indirectly in non-white people being harmed. I found that white people are very almost giddy, the white people that allege that they are against racism, to talk about the privileges and benefits that they get as a white person and how much easier navigating the world is for them as a white person. They are much more hesitant, if not completely tight-lipped, to talk about, well, what are specific things that you do to practice racism? And I think that, for me, right there goes to the sincerity. I mean, if you're a white person, if you're really sincere, you should be able to talk about ways that you have practiced racism, even if you can't think of something today. Certainly, if you're a white person and you're 20, you know you have practiced racism. You should be able to name at least five times, oh, yeah, I practiced racism here, here, and here. And it's very hard to find white people who do that. Like the white people that you were saying are sincere, like, do they list specific ways that they practice racism, not just the benefits?
I think this is a fascinating discussion that we're entering on, and I find myself in the very unusual position of being some kind of a defender or an advocate of white people and their sincerity when it comes to fighting racism. I can tell you this, that what I was saying is that there are people, white people, who in my book are making a sincere effort to challenge racism and even their privileges. And yes, I think that these people would be able to talk about white privilege and the ways they benefit from it, and also ways that they have practiced racism, if we took it there. I think they could be able to do that. However, I don't think that it's very common for white people to have to think about things that way. So I think it would take them some time to be able to say, okay, right there and at that moment and at that time. But it's fascinating that if you ask a lot of our people also, have you ever been subjugated to racism within this white supremacist knowledge system that we live? A lot of people couldn't even think about five times when they were subjugated to racism, because this is something that you need to be taught to analyze also. So, I mean, we need to check these white people. We need to, you know, show them what's up. And if they want to be a part of this, if they want to be in solidarity with us, I mean, it's also up to us to check them and make them come correct. So we try to do what we can do in that regard. But can they contribute? Yes, I think so.
That is interesting. I wanted to address the point that you raised about non-white people, the victims. If you were to ask them, like, you know, are there, can you name like five ways that you've been mistreated or subjugated, and they would struggle to be able to itemize some of the ways that they've been impacted. I think that, to me, that is the success of racism. That is what racism, white supremacy, is supposed to produce, where non-white people are not aware of it, and or non-white people are not willing to speak honestly about it. Even going back to the piece that we read from earlier, I think that's a part of being the brown noser, and I'm going to do everything I can to assimilate so I can be a thousand times better, and I'm definitely not going to be talking about racism, so people won't classify me the way that they do radical Mr. Sabuni or Mr. Momodou and some of these other folks who come out and talk about racism. I'm going to stay as far away from them as I possibly can. So I don't think it's accurate to talk about non-white people's inability to articulate or perceive racism or failure to understand racism or to even be honest about how it impacts them. I think that's very different than the way I would talk about the perpetrators of racism, because for me, a lot of this is because my foundation is that white people are not ignorant. It's not that white people need to be informed about this. They understand. They might use different language. They might use different terminology to talk about and think about, you know, the power dynamics of being a white person. But they are doing, the white people, they set this structure up in terms of the laws and legislation, who's going to be allowed into this country, who is not going to be allowed into this country. They established the Sweden Democrats. If you are a member of the group that is doing, you have to be very informed about this. And again, as I said, if you're a white person, other white people will let you know when you've made an error. So I do try to make sure that I don't compare the way that white people are not.
So what you're saying is that whereas the average black person in Sweden might not be able to list five times where they have been subjugated to racism, might not be able to make that, they don't have the tools to make that analysis. But the average white person does?
Yes, absolutely. And just because if you are a white person, you are around other white people, you know what white people talk about when there are no non-white people present. I would be willing to bet any amount of money, any day, anywhere on the planet, if you have a white person, I can guarantee they can name at least, if they're 20 years old, white man, white woman, South Africa, France, Australia, England, New Zealand, New York, I take this bet anywhere in the world, if you're a white person, you could name at least five times where you've been around other white people and they did something racist, whether it was a racist joke, whether they were making comments about a black politician or a black political, a political policy that had racist undertones. Just being around other white people, you are around racists. White people, I've had a unanimous response. As I said, we've had hundreds of white people on the program. And I'll ask them, if you are racist, do you assume, do racists assume that if you're white, you're racist? Every single time, no matter where they are on the globe, every white person I've asked has said yes, and almost immediately, no hesitation, yes, absolutely. If racist, they assume that if you're white, you're racist. And they have talked about how they've been around white people, and they make racist comments. They'll say something racist about President Obama or, as I said, immigration policy or whatever the case may be. If they're on a job, they'll make racist comments about other black employees or how they don't want non-white employees. This happens all the time, and I think this is one of those, if we could hear what white people talk about when there are no non-white people are around, I think we would have a very different perspective on white people being ignorant about all this or white people needing to be informed about all this. If we could hear the way that they talked when we are not present, because I think it's all the time. This is the dominant theme that's happening on the planet is racism, white supremacy, and white people are talking about this all the time. I could be in error, but I feel there's a lot of evidence that would support that this is undoubtedly true.
That's strong stuff. That's strong stuff.
I could be in error. I will encourage folks to ponder on it. I mentioned President Obama. I always love asking when we have particularly black people on from other parts of the world, thoughts on President Obama and particularly how you hear black people in Sweden, how you hear them talk about President Obama now that he's been in office six years.
Yes. Well, what can I tell you? Black people love him. I mean, we are, as a people, we love to take pride and joy in individual black people's achievements because that's what we have to lean back on. So they're very happy about President Obama, and to a point where they're not able either to, I mean, you can appreciate the fact that there's a black man in the White House, if you like, but I mean, we have a problem with also being critical about his job description. So that's what we have. But of course, black people are very, very enchanted and happy with President Obama.
Do you now? It almost sounded like you might have some criticism. Do you have any criticisms of what he's done or has not done in his time in the White House?
Barack Obama.
Yes, sir.
Yes, me personally, I have a lots of problems with it. But I mean, it also has something to do with power and what kind of power he actually has in that position and what are the limitations. So we shouldn't kid ourselves. But having said that, well, yes, I think that he could have been more. He could have tried to show more solidarity to other non-white people in the United States and definitely around the globe in that position where he's in. Yes.
Okay. So how would he do that? Like, what are some specifics in terms of showing solidarity to other non-white people, particularly black people?
Well, as you would also be aware of, I mean, he is the top official that runs this global European empire that subjugates the rest of the world, the so-called third world, and being in that position, well, the language that he uses to legitimize this, the way he sells it, because he's a black man in that position, and he's very, he's quite slick and he's likable, in sharp contrast to earlier U.S. presidents like Bush. So he's actually making this machinery work very well, I think. And I think that he could, he shouldn't do that. Maybe we shouldn't have a black president if we're not able if that's the kind of things that he's forced to do to be in that position, because I think it actually sustains white supremacy, the fact that he is there and does these things.
That's interesting. How do other folks respond? Like, is that something that you discuss with other black folks in Sweden, that it might be better to not have a black president if this is what he's going to be required to do?
Of course. I think this is the kind of discussion that black people need to get involved in and think about deeply. Very, very, I think it's a very relevant discussion, especially in our times. In our times where many people have reached the conclusion that we live in colorblind societies, and having Barack Obama as president of the United States is actually proof of that.
Wow. Fascinating. I know quite a few of our listening audience, they have come to the same conclusion, that they would be happy to not have President Obama in the White House or any other non-white person. As long as the system is in place, they would rather have a white person there so that we are all informed and knowledgeable that it is white people who are to blame, white people who are in charge. They're the folks that everyone should be pointing at with regards to why things are happening on the planet.
I think what I'm saying is that I think he could have done more in solidarity with black people. And I think that when he ran his election campaign, that's the kind of signals that he was giving people. So we shouldn't sit here and just say that when the powers are B are the powers to be, and that's the way things are, the way things are going. It's the only way things could have gone, and we can't expect more from a black person in a position of power. I think we should, and of course it's up to us also to make it possible for him to advocate policies that would be more in solidarity with people of color. But I don't think he has done a good job of doing that. This is a conversation between black people, so I can speak candidly.
Right on. What did you hear, I guess, when he was running that gave the impression that he was, once he got in office, if elected, that he was going to be doing things in solidarity with black people or non-white people globally?
Well, I think it was called change, vote for change. So, of course, we got the feeling that things would not happen. Question, guys, more question. How long will the interview be, and could we otherwise continue at some later point?
For sure. If you need to go, I know you have children, also functioning as a father. If you need to exit, that not a problem at all. We definitely can pick up down the road. Do you need to exit right now?
Yes, more or less. Yes,
okay.
Unfortunately.
Not a problem. We will see if we can get you back on the road in case any of the folks listening in had questions that they wanted to get in, but definitely was enjoyable having you on the broadcast, and we will see about hearing from you again in the future. Mr. Katembuwa Sabuni, thank you so much for sharing some of your Monday afternoon with us. Thoroughly enjoyed the dialogue.
Me too, Gus. Definitely. I enjoyed being a guest on the show, and I hope to be back again and continue this very, very interesting dialogue.
Absolutely. Maybe we can hear from some of the sincere white folks that you know of. You could bring one or two of them when you come back to visit us. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon, and thank you again for sharing some of your time. We wish you the best. Keep up your excellent work, sir.
Thank you, and have a good day to you, too.
Yes, sir. Take care. Context of white supremacy. I should have got your hand up if you were listening, if you had a question for Mr. Sabuni. Very interesting dialogue. I did have a couple more questions I definitely wanted to ask about this policy, I guess, of removing race. That sounds very familiar, hearing that in other parts of the world where they're talking about we're not going to mention race. I think they use some of the same terms he used, colorblind politics. We don't see race. If you talk about race, you are the racist, whether it's a non-white person or a white person, particularly non-white people. If you bring up race or racism, you are the racist. Definitely had a few more questions I wanted to ask him about that, as well as some of the articles white people have written. Of course, white people are not pleased with him at all. In Sweden, many of them, where they have all these nasty reports, apparently they had some sort of parade, I guess, a few weeks back, and they had some white person who was in blackface in the parade, and Mr. Sabuni accurately called him out for being racist, and they just went, you know, in on it. I think, as he said, that you get in more trouble for accusing someone of being a racist than you would for actually practicing racism, white supremacy against a non-white person. But they wrote, I'll read this report really quick, then we'll take our break. If folks have anything they want to get in, we should make time for that. If not, I can, oh, the sun is up now. We started this program and the sun wasn't even up. I'll read this really quick. It's from the website Happened in Sweden. This is another one. It's in Swedish, so if you go to the site, you'll have to translate it, which should be easy. But the post reads, Katimboa Sabuni, spokesperson for the African Swedish National Association, is upset about all the racism against black people in Sweden. Wherever I go, they call me Negro. He laments in the radio interview on P1 today. There are many Africans in Sweden who do not feel at ease with their black skin. Since long we have a nationwide bump, Yalo Momodu, who has the habit to police alleged hate speech whenever someone says something that does not please him. He was, however, met with opposition about this behavior this month by Jimmy Axon, racist suspect, who called him a Negro bastard and has not kept a high profile since. But one recently made tons of African Swedish, made to translation, I think some of the translation was a little off. Mr. Katimboa Sabuni has made tons of money in Sweden as alternative media have reported. He reports on Stockholm Pride participants who wore blackface paint, and today he has talked himself hoarse in the media over alleged racism. It is very clear that Sabuni has not settled as a Negro. The Negro Sabuni has a very privileged position in today's Sweden and given space in your living room whenever he wants to talk about something. But he does not see it this way. No, according to him, giving him all Swedes a cold gaze and desire for themselves that he went back to their homeland, as he put it on the radio broadcast today. I'll stop there, but it's to me it sounds very familiar in the way that I typically hear many white people in the States talk about black people who have the audacity to speak out about a race. It almost sounds like they could have been talking about Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or Melissa Harris Perry, some of the other black people, Spike Lee, some of the other black people that are more well known for speaking out and saying something about racism, being on television or in print media. Anywho, we will take a quick commercial break if folks have anything they want to get in. Before we wrap up, we can make time. Thanks for the folks who were listening live. I definitely needed a little more support to be up so early in the morning to do the broadcast, but hopefully constructive. Hopefully people enjoyed the conversation. Again, we'll take a quick commercial break, and then we will be right back. Context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at TRIMultimedia.com.
Hi everyone, welcome. This is Justice with the Cows Radio program. If you want to learn about, understand, and counter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed, packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, to be able to invest in my counter-racist efforts, co-hosting the Cows Radio program, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
I got an uncle real crazy. My Uncle B, 55 years old, hates white people, married to a white lady. And he sit around going, you know, these crackers ain't shit, except for Susan. And he tried to explain the whole thing to me one day, say, yeah, I got a white wife, I love her, she love me, that's all that matter. But I tell you this, if the revolution ever come, I'll kill her first. Just to show these crackers I mean business. Motherfucker, cracker ass, motherfucker, cracker. Shit, cracker, motherfucker. Well, hey, hi, honey. Motherfucker, cracker, I'll kill my cracker kid, too.
Right on. We will be back in, let's see if I can do the math. We will be back in about 9.5 hours, a little less. 9.5 hours. We should be back 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific this evening. Dr. Missy Harris. make sure I get that right now. I was confused. I thought we were going to be doing the program yesterday, Sunday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, but it's today. I got my dates one day off, but no worries. She will be in this evening, so if you were disappointed or confused, just tune in, as I said, approximately 9.5 hours, really about 9 hours and 20 minutes. Dr. Missy Harris will be joining us this evening. That is the black female dentist who her white colleagues were spying on her, her social networking activities. They were upset because she was writing about Ferguson and the shooting death of Michael Brown Jr., and they said that they were it was unacceptable to have her writing about this, and she was going to have to stop immediately. So she tendered her resignation. She'll be joining us later this evening. That is very unfortunate, but you should keep that in mind during the course of the dialogue. Anywho, as we are doing two programs today, I will definitely make sure I get my plug in. Invest if you think the program is constructive racism notes. blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com, listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal is in the top right corner. If you are not interested in investing via PayPal, drop me a line. We can get you a mailing address. definitely appreciate all of the folks who have contributed, helped to keep us on the air for slowly creeping on 6 years. Hope it has been constructive. If you are not getting useful information that is helping you become less confused about racism, white supremacy, white people, improving your quality of life and helping you become a better problem solver, better at using logic and asking questions, then definitely do not tune in, because we have way too many problems as black people to be wasting time listening to stuff that is just not improving our position, understanding under the system of racism, white supremacy. But thanks to folks who've tuned in and supported over the years. Just three quick things I will get in again. If you have questions, you should get your hand up, because we will just do our 2 hours, unless folks have anything that they are dying to get in about what they heard from Mr. Sabuni or anything else you want to get in on early Monday morning. Number one, I am going to do a jig. Remember all those photos and videos of black people, and they had a lot of white people too, crying and celebrating when President Obama was elected. It is going to be the exact opposite for me. When he leaves in 2016, if I'm still alive and we are still broadcasting, it is going to be Party Central in January of 2017 hits and he exits the White House. Like, man, whoopee. I feel like it has just been massive. And this is no reflection on Mr. Sabuni. Just, this has been my, I think people have heard me give similar commentary before. Just the amount of confusion all the way around from having him in the White House under a system of white supremacy. I'm going to be elated when he leaves. It will definitely be party time for Gus T. Also, I wanted to ask him, I had two things I wanted to get in. We will definitely have to get him back for a return visit, hopefully with some of those well-meaning, sincere white folks. But number one, I wanted to ask him, because I think he is Muslim. I was going to ask him that, and it was in connection to all of this about ISIS, to see what the perception is and how white people are talking, if at all, about ISIS in Sweden. And if they are connecting the group known as ISIS to black people in general. I definitely wanted to hear that, particularly since he is a black male who I think, unless I've been misinformed, identifies as a Muslim. But that's definitely one I want to ask. We can get him back. And the other one, in the report where they were talking about this proposed change in legislation where they don't have the term race anymore in Sweden, and this is not final. They're supposed to study this, take some months or years to come to some conclusion on this. But they wrote, the government has assigned Chief District Court Judge Erica Hempke the task of investigating the issue, changing, removing the term race, as well as looking into expanding protection of transgender people in Swedish legislation. Both assignments should be completed by December 7, 2015. Notice that as well. Got to stick as Mr. Fuller. The gay rights movement is changing everything. I was eager to hear his thoughts on that as well. Last, the report I thought was profound on some of the things that it shared and how consistently a lot of these things mirror what's happening in the U.S. Again, this is on the New York Times Sunday Review. Jonas Hansen Kamiri was published April 20th, 2013. I read some of it earlier. I'm just going to read a little bit towards what's at the end. I'm still not reading the whole thing, but I'll post it on Facebook. I'll tweet it as well so you can check it out at your leisure if you are so inclined. He goes on to write, being 15 and sitting outside an electronics store when a police van pulls up, two officers get out, ask for ID, ask what's up tonight. Then they hop back into the van. And all the time, a fight inside, one voice says they have no goddamn right to prejudge us. They can't cordon off the city with their uniforms. They can't make us feel insecure in our own neighborhoods. But the other voice says, what if it was our fault? We were probably talking too loudly. We were wearing hoodies and sneakers. We could have chosen to have less melanin in our skin. We happen to have last names that reminded this country that it is part of a larger world. We were young. Everything would definitely be different when we got older. But then we replaced the hoodie with a black coat, the cap with a scarf. We stopped playing basketball and started studying economics. One day we were standing outside the Central Station, jotting something down in a notebook. Because even if we were studying economics, we had a secret dream of becoming an author. Suddenly someone appeared, a broad man with an earpiece, asked for ID, pushed our arms up, and dragged us toward the police van. Apparently, we matched a description. Apparently, we looked like someone else. We sat in the van for 20 minutes alone, but not really alone, because 100 people were walking by, and they looked in at us with a look that whispered, "There, one more, another one who is acting in complete accordance with our prejudices. I wish you had been with me in the police van. I sat there alone, and I met all the eyes walking by and tried to show them that I wasn't guilty, that I had just been standing in a place and looking a particular way, but it's hard to argue one's innocence on the back seat of a police van, and it's impossible to be a part of society when everyone continually assumes that you are not. After 20 minutes, I was released. No apology, no explanation. Instead, you can go now." I will stop there again. There's more to it. You can read it on your own. Sweden's Closet Racists, Jonas Hansen Kamiri. You can check it out. I'm putting it on my Facebook page right now. I guess I'll make sure I get in as well before the program concludes. If you saw the segment, I think Lashes did, probably some of the other listeners did as well, these folks who watched the stream. If you saw that piece, I did not enjoy that broadcast at all. They had a non-white person on who I felt like was just there, at least my opinion, just to argue with Mr. Sabuni. They had a white person there who was saying that this is great and even said he was an anti-racist and that we need to go ahead and take race out of legislation and it doesn't serve any good. It's just connected to biological racism and blah, blah, blah. But I just the whole way that that particular broadcast was organized and managed, it was loathsome, in my opinion. There was one point, I think, where Mr. Sabuni was classified as being incredibly petty because he mentioned some racist suspect who had been on television and writing newspaper articles talking about radical Muslims and that sort of thing. And I just wanted to know who the person was. Like, I have no problem if we're talking to people who are in different parts of the world and they're mentioning people or events that I don't know about. Just explain what you're talking about. That way we're all on the same page. And I even understand, as Dr. Ani says, no one is objective. Everybody comes with their own political agenda, so that's fine. Just tell me who the person is that you're talking about, and if I so choose, I can do research to get more information and to develop my own opinion about this person. But I did not enjoy that segment at all for a myriad of reasons. At any rate, you can still check out the stream. They have a lot of programs that I have enjoyed and guests that I have enjoyed hearing from, and they frequently talk about racism, white supremacy on the stream. Al Jazeera's finest. Speaking of which, our own Femi OK, did you have a question or comment that you wanted to get in?
Good morning. I thought the conversation was interesting. I find it funny that in Sweden they want to remove the term race, yet want to explicitly put forth the term transgender terminology within protection within the Sweden Constitution. So I thought that was rather interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had like triple asterisks next to that to ask him about that, just to see what his thoughts are on that. But that absolutely, we can get explicit language in to hook so-called transgender people up, but we don't want to have anything that is explicitly dealing with race because that would promote racism somehow. So fascinating contradictions.
The whole notion of it would be promoting race sounds very similar how it functions in France as well. like how France does in Cali, like have a census program like we do here in the United States on who's black and who's white, even though I do suspect they do, they just don't have it as publicly available in France at all. It's just like a taboo in a sense. Everyone is French, period.
Oh, are you still with us? Not hearing you? Oh, looks like she got disconnected. If she lashes joins us again, I will get her line open. But, yeah, I agree with that point. I think France is known for that, not publicly anyway, identifying race and egalitarian with the verbiage that they use. We're all in this together. We don't see color, and which is just rubbish. And even the success of Marie Le Pen and the her national party, which is very similar to UKIP and the Sweden Democrats that we were talking about, these quote-unquote far-right groups. It's, in my opinion, that's another one of those blatant contradictions that we don't talk about race in France, but Marie Le Pen and her group, they almost are explicitly, in not a very concealed way at all, talk about racism all the time, and their appeal, France is for Frenchmen, talking about white people, and we're going to keep our language, and we're not going to be opposed, and we're not going to be encroached upon by all these non-white people who are not even talking about non-white people. We're not going to have them just come in and take over our way of life and dictate to us how we're going to live, which is they're presenting it, in my opinion, in just very explicit, undeniable racist language in France, unless I've been misinformed. Are you back with us, Lashes?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Did you get chopped off, or did you get out what you were trying to say?
I had an incoming call, and I hit the wrong button, tried to cancel the incoming call, but, yeah, that's what happened.
Right on. The caller at 8179, did you have questions, comments you wanted to get in as well?
Hi, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Wonderful. Good morning, Gus, and thanks for having, I missed his name, but your guest on today. I thought the conversation was quite interesting, and like the previous caller said, I thought it was interesting how they want to remove the word race, but they are not interested in removing the obvious activity that some of the people practice. You know, when you all were stating, or when he stated that there was someone who painted their face black with black paint, and then once someone speaks out about it, they're the one who's, so to speak, ostracized or something like that. I think that's interesting, and it just once again continues to prove the confusion that the racist white supremacists like to just promote. I mean, that's confusing. You know, it really doesn't do any good if you're going to just remove the word. I wanted to also ask the guest, how is interracial marriage or dating, what is that like over there? It would just been interesting to hear his thoughts on that, and if you know if that's promoted. I have a uncle. He lives in Germany, and he is married to a white woman. And I've always questioned him about, you know, it's just like he makes it seem like it's just, oh, that's normal. Racism isn't, you know, it's okay in our quote-unquote circle. Not racism, I'm sorry, but interracial dating. And, you know, I just, again, it's just interesting, you know, to hear their perspective on that, because as he, my uncle would always mention, well, there's just not a lot of black women over here to choose from. And so then he, you know, makes his decision to marry a white woman. But that's all I wanted to share. Thanks for waking up early and giving us the program at this early hour. It was convenient for me. So that's all I wanted to add.
Right on. I definitely had that on my list as well to ask about tragic arrangements. I know he has a child. I was even going to ask if mother of his child is a white person or non-white person. We will get to that next time around. We get him back on the program, because I think that's interesting, too, to see how that dynamic is contributing to the confusion or hindering black people's understanding of racism, white supremacy, when you have a lot of that sexual sewering going on, and it ends up impairing your ability to accurately understand what it means to be a white person and the system of racism, white supremacy. But yeah, I was definitely curious about that as well, if that's happening in this environment where, yeah, we're not even supposed to be talking about race because we're all hooking up together and everything is all good. Or if that's even being used directly or indirectly in the way the Sweden Democrats, that's the group that's, I guess, they're more explicit about things. They're, it's in the New York Times where it says that this group has, their roots are racism, white supremacy. It says white supremacy in the New York Times article. So I can only take that to mean this must be a very, we're blatant about what we're doing, white supremacy type organization. But I would even be curious if that's in the language that they use to try to galvanize white people to support and come out and vote for them and back their party, if they have any concerns or language or imagery that's connected to white women are being taken, or, you know, savage, uncouth, sexually lascivious black people are a problem that we need to contain. But that will, got that bowl printed for next time. Hopefully we can get him back on the program.
I have a question. This is Lashes. Did he discuss power in relation to his conversation on the air? Because I don't recall him doing so.
Can he discuss what now?
Power.
Power relations between white people and non-white people?
Yeah.
Let me see.
Or just connecting the word power to racism, white supremacy, period. I don't think he really did that.
I know he used the word privilege a lot in the program, and that, you know, stands out for me. I want to say I think he did at least one point. That wasn't the major emphasis. A lot of it did focus, unless I'm in error, I think a lot of it did focus on white people and privilege. Maybe he didn't. I might even be imagining. Maybe he didn't. I thought he'd used the word power at least once in talking about white people having, you know, a more powerful position than non-white people, but I might be in error. Maybe that maybe he didn't say it, but I know he definitely used the term privilege a lot in the way that he talked about white people and them having privilege, non-white people not having privilege.
The only reason why I bring that up is because he kept saying that, oh, you know, even some anti-racists who fight against racial discrimination in Sweden, yet they don't know that they, how did he say it? He uses terms like, oh, some white people just don't know what they're doing, or don't know, they don't really believe that they are racist, some crap
right.
like that.
Right.
And that's like, yeah, I don't think he really brought up power if he kept saying that notion over and over again, nor does he, the guest, this is just my opinion, doesn't seem to understand that what he is describing is just pure rhetoric. It's like a cover. Then you went into explanation like how that explanation of them not knowing is the equivalent of a criminal not wanting to be exposed. So I just don't think he really quite grasped that connection with rhetoric and in terms of white people saying they don't know, and also how he thinks that they truly don't know because he's not making, the guest is not making a connection with racism, white supremacy, with power and domination.
Yeah, that's, I'd have to go back to listen to see if he used the word power at all, or if he used it, like I said, I think if he did, it was not as frequent as the word privilege, and it definitely seemed like he was convinced he had a lot vested in there are well-meaning white people that are not informed, they're not aware, they really believe and think that they are not racist, and they don't understand, they need to be educated, which is very common. We've heard that from all over the world. South Africa, that's non-white people, I guess, just get conditioned, groomed to think about white people in that way, and somehow it's our job to educate them, properly inform them so that they will stop behaving in this manner. To me, it's just obviously not true. It's so far from being accurate and honest about the world in which we live and what it means to be a white person. I feel like that's a major contributor as to why we have not been able to solve this problem. White people know that they have more power, and they greatly understand what it means to be a white person in relation to non-white people. And I think some of that is just us being resistant for a myriad of reasons, regards to just being honest about white people and them being knowledgeable, invested, dedicated to the practice of racism, white supremacy. I think at some level it's more comforting to think that these people are doing all of this and they just don't know, that they're ignorant or stupid or need to be informed somehow. It might be more comforting at some level, but it is certainly not helpful with regards to being accurate in solving this problem, in my opinion.
To the female caller, if she's still online, did she hear the word power in the conversation?
A179, are you still there? Looks like she's still with us.
I'm sorry, my line was muted, but not particularly. I would have to go back and listen, but I can't say that I did or did not.
Guess what other portion of the interview stuck out most for you?
The comparison, when I asked him if he knew any white people that were sincere, and then if any of the white people that he said he did know that were sincere about ending racism, if they talk about the ways that they practice racism, and not just the benefits and goodies that they get from being a white person. And it somehow went pretty quickly to non-white people not being able to identify ways that they're victims. For me, that just stood out because I feel like that's also a pattern that I hear pretty consistently, where we are talking about white people and them practicing racism, and somehow it gets to, well, non-white people are, in error too. Non-white people are not doing the correct thing as well. And I think he did concede that they're victims, but we could talk about that, that's fine, but I mean, that's not even the context of the question. We were talking about white people, and do they list specific ways that they practice racism? And again, I don't know if that too could be a part of the victimization, where we just don't want to take an honest and in-depth look at these well-meaning white people who might be our friends, who might, I think he said that about 100 to 200 white people are a part of his organization. National Afro-Swedish Association. I think he said it was about 10 to 20% white, so 100 to 200 white people. I don't know if these are some of the folks he was referencing, if he has white friends, white pals. He has been in Sweden since he was 4, but that I thought was highly significant. And again, that's just a pattern that I've seen pretty consistently, where we will start off talking about white people, the perpetrators in the crime of white supremacy, and somehow it'll shift to an indictment of non-white people, what we're doing or not doing. What else stood out? His commentary on the white people in Sweden pointing out racism and saying, oh, yes, there's racism in America, and Michael Brown, that's racism, but we over here are cool. I thought that was pretty interesting as well. His thoughts on President Obama, I thought that was interesting. I was even trying to rack my brain when he said that in his campaign that he was making overtures, at least, that things were going to be friendlier or some sort of reaching out to non-white people globally, because I did not remember that. I remember him throwing Reverend Wright under the bus, probably being required to do so by whites that are going to have him be in the White House. But I didn't remember anything explicitly. I definitely could have missed it. I could have even forgotten. It's been so long, but I didn't remember that. I mean, he said hope and change. That I think that hope and change got a whole lot of people, because that's so vague. It's not. It doesn't really pull out anything specifically. But I thought that was definitely interesting. And him even saying, I think explicitly, that maybe it would be better to not have a black person in the White House. I know Scotty Reed and several other folks have said that. And as I said, I myself will be having major party when January 2007 rolls around, if I'm still alive, to celebrate him exiting. It will be a glorious day when that happens, if the system is still in place. Anything else stick out being important? That'd probably be the top stuff I can think of for now. But major asterisk, the point where the question pivoted away from specific things that white people do to practice racism to non-white people not being informed or able to articulate how they are victimized. Major asterisk there. And I think even at that point he said that he felt like he was in the unusual position of defending white people, which that major asterisk there as well.
Wow. In relation to you, that's hilarious. As far as having a conversation with you, I think that's just hilarious.
Absolutely. I don't think white people should be defended ever. I'd say any non-white people under the system of white supremacy, if you find yourself in the position of defending white people, it is time to pause and make a serious reevaluation, in my opinion. That would go for me and any non-white person as long as the system is in place. Because that we just get groomed to function in that way. It's not even a personal indictment. It's just that happens all the time. You probably go through the archives if it's a non-white person participating in the discussion and count. I don't know, we've done over 1,000 broadcast hours. I'm sure you could find at least 500 times where a non-white person has been defending either individual white people or white people collectively in some way, shape, or form. That is ubiquitous in the system. That, again, that is racist success. That's what the system is designed to produce, where we would just go out and defend white people. And to me, that, again, is why I said I had it written down to ask about the quote-unquote interracial relationships and white friends and all that stuff, because that just increases that sort of behavior in terms of defending white people.
I agree, and I think that the caller positive attributes of it coming about President Obama doing some nice friendly things for non-white people in other parts of the globe, I think it was when President Obama was already in his first term and he made that trip to Egypt. This is before Egypt was overthrown, before the Arab Spring. He spoke, made some nice, pleasantry commentary where even the Arabs in Egypt actually thought, oh, wow, the United States might turn a new leaf. I forgot what speech it was. It was broadcast internationally on the international channels. And I remember other European news market were talking about that speech. So I think he was referring to that as well as President Obama's trip to West Africa and other African nations within the continent. So I think that's what he was probably alluding to. Because think about it, probably they, meaning the European or non-American viewers, are viewing only from an international lens, not from an American. They're not getting American domestic news broadcast daily. You understand what I mean? Like we are here in the United States. So that's what he could be alluding to.
I see. I reckon I'd have to I want to ask him, is that what he's referencing?
Can I add something to that?
Yes, ma'am.
I think also that I don't think President Obama necessarily even would have had to say anything to give him that impression. I just think the fact that a black man was elected as president and his platform was change and hope just gave everybody this false illusion that there was going to be some kind of change. And so, I mean, because even when I reflect back and try to listen to President Obama, he's never really said anything that would even make me think that he was going to be able to even be in a position to do that. He's just, you know, I think just the fact that it was a change just based off of the color of his skin, and that was the illusion that, you know, well, maybe he's going to do something. But I'm like you, Gus. I mean, we're going to party hard when he gets out of there because it's just, you know, oh, my goodness, I'm counting down. So, yeah, I think that, you know, it was just a false platform. Basically, you know, maybe he thought he was going to do some changing or, you know, something like that. But, no, not really. So I just wanted to add that in there.
I, too, will be excited to see President Obama leave. I didn't vote for him the first term, so I knew what was coming down the pipe. And I still keep saying it, Gus. We're ushering in, I say, the Jim Crow 3.0 version once he leaves. So You better get prepared.
I see that now. I see that now. Like, you can't turn on the television without a black person being shot or raped or whatever else white people are doing. It looks, it just looks really, really bad, and getting worse by the day, and just, in my opinion, compounded by the confusion and this sort of, even in an environment where you have so many people talking about racism now, it just, that's the exact same thing that happened last summer, right, when everybody was talking about racism because the trial for Trayvon Martin's death. The exact same thing this summer with all of these instances forcing a lot of non-white people to talk about racism, but it becomes all the more obvious the astronomical amount of confusion that non-white people have about racism. And really, I mean, to really just get to the core about what it means to be a white person and why these events keep happening, why we continue to be frustrated, why white people behave the way that they do when these incidents happen, with just all the way around, white people wearing armbands. I am Darren Wilson. I mean, in my opinion, that nothing makes it more obvious what it means to be a white person, that you have a market where a lot of white people are buying and proudly wearing, white enforcement officers are wearing armbands that say, I am Darren Wilson. Like, that just, you don't get any clearer than that. But just that lack of understanding in terms of why these events keep happening, it just looks really bad. I feel like that, I know you've mentioned that consistently. I think the way you used to phrase it was 21st century post Reconstruction. That looks like they are already getting rolling with that right now. Just everything. Daniel Holtzclaw and raping these black females, and John Crawford being gunned down. I think these are snuff flicks. I mean, that was a big part of post Reconstruction. You celebrate and make it a public spectacle the murder and torture of black people. That's what we're looking at every day. Marlene Pinnock being beaten down on camera, and then she gets arrested and ticketed for this. John Crawford, gunned down on camera, no indictment. The black male in South Carolina, even though he didn't die, but him getting gunned down on camera, and you just keep going and keep going. Michael Brown Jr., and just all of it, and the television programs and movies, No Good Deed, and just all of it. I feel like it's one big spectacle celebrating black death and torture of black people. I feel like that is on and rolling right now, and I just expect it to keep getting worse and worse and worse. The Purge, all of that. I feel like we're watching it right now in conjunction with mass astronomical levels of confusion amongst non-white people. Very dangerous times.
Like, this is me again. Like how you mentioned the entertainment portion of things, the spectacle, watching people, for black people, die and be mistreated. It's kind of similar to the notion of a public lynching, and also the reoccurrence of new programming motif of the 1913 release of Birth of a Nation, which talked about, okay, this is how the United States is operating with these Negroes in office, where you have, like, white people dressed up as in blackface, pretend to be black congressmen in Congress, you know, buffoonery within the halls of Congress. So it's very, very similar. And also in the international realm, it just seems like there's a hard reset going on in all various non-white nations, where it's kind of like a hard reset to making the ground right for the actual initial phase of Europeans coming to various non-white areas of the world, to which usher in imperialism and various empires, whether it was the British Empire, the French Empire, et cetera. So it just seems so similar.
Isabel Wilkerson, she wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, and she's super fine, in my opinion. She wrote a piece for The Guardian. It was right at the end of August. Mike Brown's shooting and Jim Crow lynchings have too much in common. It's time for America to own up. Now, I don't agree with, you know, we talk about this with her, but I don't agree with her assessment of white people and the system on a whole. But she has a photograph of the protest in Ferguson, and she has that juxtaposed with a lynching, a public lynching of a black person on a scaffold, and it's got justice written on the scaffold, no less. But that's like the crux of what she's saying, that all of these public televised murders and beatings of black people, that's exactly what it is. Like, I posted it a few months back. I posted it when it came out, but let me see if I can find a nice juicy part to share so that I can encourage folks. Because she talks about how it's even worse now because these photographs didn't have the same reach as YouTube, right? Like, white people globally in the millions can celebrate, oh, yeah, let's get our popcorn and watch John Crawford get gunned down at Walmart, or let's watch Marlene Pinnock get savagely beaten by this brute officer in California. Like, millions of white people can watch and comment and snicker amongst themselves. Like, that's much grander than what we were talking about at the turn of the 20th century with these lynching photographs. She says, not terribly long ago in a country that many people misremember if they knew it at all, a black person was killed in public every 4 days for often the most mundane of infractions, or rather accusations of infractions, for taking a hog, making boastful remarks, for stealing 75 cents. For the most banal of missteps, the penalty could be an hours-long spectacle of torture and lynching. No trial, no jury, no judge, no appeal. Now, well into a new century, as a family in Ferguson, Missouri buries yet another American teenager killed at the hands of authorities, the rate of police killings of black Americans is nearly the same as the rate of lynchings in the early decades of the 20th century. About twice a week or every 3 or 4 days, an African-American has been killed by a white police officer in the 7 years ending in 2012, according to studies of the latest data compiled by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Those studies, that is minimal, because they don't even have a full collection in this report, so it's more frequent than that. At any rate, that number is, just keep reading. The number is incomplete and likely an undercount, as only a fraction of local police jurisdictions even report such deaths, and those reported are the ones deemed somehow justifiable. That means that despite the attention given the deaths of teenagers Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis, their cases would not have been included in that already grim statistic, not only because they were not killed by police, but because the state of Florida, for example, is not included in the limited data compiled by the FBI. The haunting symmetry of a death every 3 or 4 days links us to an uglier time that many would prefer not to think about, which reminds us that the devaluation of black life in America is as old as the nation itself and has yet to be confronted. Beyond the numbers, it is the banality of injustice, the now predictable playing out of 21st century convention, the swift killing, the shaming of the victim rather than inquiry into the shooter, the kitchen table protest signs, Twitter handles, and spontaneous symbols of grievance, whether hoodies or Skittles or hands in the air, the spectacle of death by skin color, all of it connects the number evil, the numbing evil of a public hanging in 1918 to the numbing evil of a sidewalk killing uploaded on YouTube in the summer of 2014. Lynchings were, of course, distinct from today's police killings. They were ritualistic displays of public violence before sometimes thousands of people, including children. They were intended to reinforce the arbitrary rules of a race-based caste system, primarily in the American South. One white father in Texas took his toddler to a lynching in Waco in 1916 for that express purpose. He propped the boy up on his shoulders as 18-year-old Jesse Washington was burned alive. "My son can't learn too young," the man said. I thought white people were ignorant. But there are parallels between the violence of the past and what happens today. Images and stereotypes built into American culture had fed prevailing assumptions of black inferiority and wantonness since before the time of Jim Crow. Many of those stereotypes persist to this day and have mutated with times. Last century's beasts and savage have become this century's gangbanger and thug, embedding a pre-written script for subconscious bias that primes many to accept what they were programmed to believe about black Americans, whether they are aware of it or not. I will stop there. As I said, I obviously do not agree with everything. I've concluded white people are very aware of what they are doing and what's going on with these black murders. All you have to do is look at the comments, any of these videos that get posted online, but the general thrust of what she's saying in that parallel to what's happening now to what was a regular occurrence post Reconstruction, I definitely agree and would encourage folks to check out this article. Mike Brown's shooting and Jim Crow lynchings have too much in common. It's time for America to own up. That should be white. That's why I said when people, we do start talking about racism, and a lot of this I know is because we are not permitted, particularly if it's a non-white person in the academy or they got a big job or whatever the case may be, even including President Obama, they're not allowed to speak honestly about racism. But I feel like that is a major part of the problem. Like, if with everything that's happening right now, it is imperative to be as honest, as accurate as we possibly can be. It is not America. It is, let's be honest about what it means to be a white person, their thoughts, speech, actions, emotions as it relates to non-white people, especially black people. Yeah, I will hush there. Anybody, y'all have anything else you want to get in?
Well, as far as the need for honesty, of course. However, white supremacy, whether it's white American culture, et cetera, functions on dishonesty, domination, distinction on a daily basis. It can't function on honesty. It just simply can't. Because with dishonesty, it allows the white culture, white supremacy, to exploit anyone at a given moment, will, and time. So honesty is not part of the equation. It will never be.
All the more reason, in my opinion, for us to have the courage to be honest. Just, I think they even, if you want to get biblical for a moment, they do say the truth shall set you free. We should have the courage to try to be as honest as we possibly can about racism at all times. And this is why I know we all have a different understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. According to how you understand white supremacy to operate, what it means to be a white person, be honest. Have the courage to be honest about that at all times, consistently, whether you're talking publicly, privately. Have the courage to honestly present your views on what's happening, because that works totally against their system. As you said, white people, they need dishonesty. They need deception. They need for people to not be accurate when they talk about racism. That gives them immense strength. I think Mr. Fuller, he says their primary weapon is deceit. You directly counter their system when you speak accurately and honestly about racism, white supremacy, white people. Really make an effort to be as honest as you can under these conditions. And I would just, I mean, hey, if you need any other motivation, inspiration, just turn on the news and what you see happening every day, not just Ferguson, Jonathan Crawford, as I said, Marlene Pinnock, Daniel Holtzclaw, white enforcement officer, has raped at least 8 black females, and he gets bonded out. And white people do the same thing. They raise thousands of dollars for him in a matter of days. Just turn on the television, what's happening with black people. If you can sit on that and not be truthful about it, then, you know, okay, that's part of your victimization too. You got a VGQ. But I would encourage, if you say you are attempting to work against racism, white supremacy, just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. That has a huge impact.
Yeah, because my 4 D's of racism, white supremacy are deception, distinction, domination, and dishonesty. All 4 of those D words operate at the same time. Deception, distinction, domination, and dishonesty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I am hopeful. Number one, people listening to the program will be have the courage, be more accurate in their presentation. And I'm not saying you got to go around on your job and, you know, run around and indict people as suspected race soldiers. I'm not saying that. Definitely use some intelligence as you are courageous and speaking truthfully. But, I mean, at minimum, speaking honestly to other non-white people, speaking honestly to yourself, not lying to yourself, being honest with your offspring, being honest with potential partners, friends, family members. I think that definitely is something that we can all put in practice. If you write online about racism, white supremacy, just being honest about it, I think just that alone has a huge impact, in my opinion. Unless folks have anything else they want to get in before we wrap up, again, we will be back a little later today, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Missy Harris. will be on the program. We'll be looking forward to hearing from her. Anyone listening in, folks, have anything else they want to get in before we conclude?
No, we just need to be committed. We need to have courage. We need to be honest, and we need to be codified.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
That'll be all for me. See you in 9 hours.
Right on. Hopefully folks will chime in, have some questions ready for Dr. Harris. We'll be good to hear from her. She said she's excited to speak with us. I'm excited to speak to her as well. She gave me extra time. I told her assistant or publicist, I don't know how she's functioning, but her intermediary, that she gave extra time to prepare. So I will have more information about her to be ready to go. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Dr. Missy Harris joining us live to talk about how she ended up not being employed any longer with her white colleagues. Just a quick side note, since she was a dentist, and they said explicitly, it's in one of the posts, I think one of the ones that I read before, where she went to, it was a dinner or some sort of function with President Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, and her white colleagues found out. That's one thing you can do right there. Make sure you racialize white people, as they say. Identify individuals who are white. Identify them as such. That one thing you can do that is helpful. But she went to this dinner or what have you. She went to this dinner or what have you, and her colleagues were like, wait a minute, you're not going with that Negro in the White House, are you? We're Republicans. It wouldn't be good for your career for you to be hanging out any function with President Obama. And she went anyway, but it reminded me of Dr. John Hoberman's book. He is a white man, and he's written several books on racism, but the one more recently, it's Black and Blues. It talks about racism in the healthcare industry. And he was basically saying that you have all these racist disparities where black people aren't treated well when they go to the hospital or seek a physician or medical help. But none of the white doctors say that they're racist. Like, everybody has all these excuses like, oh, no, we're not racist. We love black people. They're the greatest. And blah, blah, blah. He was saying that cannot be true. And this is a white man. He's just saying that cannot be true. It's got to be some of these white people are racist to explain this. And he said if you dig deeper, when you look at these people, their political affiliations and how they view the world, it's what they would call very conservative, right-wing, Republican, policies that are explicitly against black people. He said he thinks that right there starts to get at some of what's happening here. But I would just say keep that in mind when Dr. Harris visits with us this evening. She was the only black person in her dental office. And, just keep that in mind along with the cowbell. Anywho, we'll be back a little later today. Hopefully folks will have a safe, enjoyable, codified, and constructive Monday. If you get confused along the way, feel free. Drop an email or tweet at Until Justice. If you can't find something in the archive or have a question about a guest or something of that nature, suggestion, feel free to let us know. Thanks for all the folks who tuned in early. Appreciated the moral support early on a Monday morning. We will speak with you soon. Shout out to Justice. Hope she's doing something constructive with her day. We hope. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Creator. Allow us to be codified and courageous, dedicated to replacing white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.